Hi. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, back on the air again with a new show. Our show last week was about these sexual variations in fish and shellfish. And today my co-host is here again, Carol Butler, and she's going to do most of the talking today, and I'm going to ask us probably some annoying questions or some questions about it. So remember that our sponsor is Whole Foods Markets, and this is the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm the Naturalist. And Carol, what are you going to start off with today?
Well, I would like to talk about sexual conflict. You talked in the last program about matings and where the evolutionary interests of the reproductive partners were basically in tune, right? So they were cooperating, right, whether it was mutualism or whether it was the slipper shells where they were the same species reproducing, but everything was copacetic.
Right.
Right. But we know that that's not always the way it is.
Especially with people.
And with animals. I'm talking a lot about insects, but it's the same thing. We'll talk about people too. So sexual conflict is the conflict between the evolutionary interests of the male and the female, right? Because the reproductive partners are genetically different, so sometimes they have different aims. This is different from sexual selection, which arises from competition between members of one sex for the other sex, right? So conflict. I thought since we have the luxury of being archived, I would mention the sort of the main sources for this material because it's really interesting.
Oh, good
and
idea.
That way, all if right. you are interested in this topic, you can do some reading or look up stuff that I've talked about. So there's a fellow named Jeffrey Parker. He writes as G.A. Parker, who introduced the concept of sperm competition, which we'll talk about. And almost every article about sexual conflict refers to Parker, usually to this paper on sperm competition, which was in a book called Sexual Selection and Reproductive Competition in Insects. Mm-hmm. So sort of keep that in mind. There's a lot of generalizations, but a lot of this is coming from insects. Mm-hmm. And he recently did a big overview of this field in the 2006 issue of Biology Letters. The other person who's really important and writes fascinating stuff is William Eberhard. His book is Female Control, Sexual Selection by Cryptic Female Choice. And cryptic female choice usually refers to the female exerting reproductive control after mating.
After mating.
That's what makes it cryptic.
Uh-huh.
So it's often within the reproductive tract that this goes on.
Oh,
so
okay, because cryptic means secret or right, undercover.
Right,
or,
exactly.
Or hidden.
Hidden, right. And then the other book that relates to this, which is one of my favorite books. I like Bernie's book, too, very much.
The Kaplan book.
The Kaplan book is wonderful. Say the name again.
The Sensuous Seas.
The Sensuous Seas is a wonderful book. Bernie lent it to me, and I bought a copy and loved it. This book is called The Evolution of Human Sexuality by Donald Simons. This book is from 1981, but he really is one of the first people to really talk about human sexuality in terms of innate behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the biologists describe the slipper shells, he describes human behavior, and in particular sexual behavior, in terms of evolutionary advantage.
Okay, let's get down to the juicy parts now, Cash.
Okay, well that means fruit flies.
Fruit flies, right. We'll start with, right.
Okay. The humans, we're talking about in mostly insects, if you think about the principles in sexual conflict, it has very interesting implications, which I know Bernie will relate to in terms of people. I'll give just one example from Simons, and then we'll turn to the insects. He writes about why do the physical characteristics that correlate with youth almost always play a big part in determining a woman's attractiveness. It's not true with men, right?
No, not as
not
such
nearly
a,
as much.
No. No. Men, it's power.
Right.
Women want a powerful man.
Right.
And successful.
And
man.
The reason for that is the reason for that is very primitive. It's
right.
from
Goes
these pre-literate societies,
right.
which are the model for this behavioral analysis, where the woman would be pregnant all the time or nursing and limited in her ability to take care of herself. And so she needed to select a mate who was strong and powerful and a good provider, right?
Right.
Now both women and men work, and that's a lot less important, and that's become, there are different patterns where the male is not always a provider. But the biological model from these early societies is exactly that. And the woman, the attractiveness for the woman is that she appears to be reproductively available.
Right, that's the youth
right.
part of it.
So that
right.
in our culture, we see women of all ages trying to look, we call it looking young,
right.
but we're really trying to look reproductively available by dyeing our hair and dressing in a snazzy way and wearing all kinds of attractive clothing,
right.
which doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the culture at this point, but it's based on that concept of reproductive availability.
So that's still very powerful.
Very powerful biologically. So
right.
this is what I want you to just keep in mind, how our biology is very much
biology
still
is,
operating.
Biology is destiny.
That's right.
To
Somebody
quote my friend.
Said that.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So let's see. Sometimes, for example, I mean, Bernie's example is there wasn't conflict. Sometimes, for example, when the male of a species is larger than the female, it may be less costly for females to prevent mating than for males to achieve it against her resistance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Persistent harassment by males is likely to have a negative effect on females, and she may gain by avoiding that cost.
No, you're talking about insects right now, but
that
certainly holds over to humans
a lot,
also.
Right.
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
I like you to sort of think about this loosely,
right.
and if it doesn't make sense, then think about insects.
Okay.
But I try to think about it more loosely. So when the ideal outcome for a given character trait for one sex is different than the ideal outcome for the other, conflict ensues, right? And mating conflict arises between the benefits of mating versus its costs, sometimes in terms of pre-copulatory, so seduction, conquest, pre-mating decisions, or post-copulatory, which is the Eberhardt stuff, female choice concerning, okay, she mates because it makes sense to mate for a complex series of reasons, but it's to her advantage to have multiple mates.
Uh-huh.
So
okay.
what does she do with the sperm? She doesn't,
right.
so she gets rid of some of the sperm. She actually, this is true with insects, butterflies do this, that they can either expel some of the ejaculate or they actually can select from the ejaculate from various males. Bees do this. Bee queen bees mate with a whole bunch of males
right.
once
well,
in their lives in those mating flights that we talked about.
Yeah, it could be hundreds.
Thousands and
thousands,
right. And they have a lifetime of sperm stored up, and they choose from the sperm that's inside their bodies.
Do we know anything about that mechanism, how they can choose from the sperm in their bodies? That's really, really...
Well, I think it's the sort of thing at this point people only speculate about
yeah.
because it's really difficult to study. Okay.
That's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, so the male sometimes has toxins that prevent her from remating or from using that kills a sperm that was deposited by another male. There's all kinds of variations on this. Our segment is up, but we talked about butterflies and how the male puts a plug in the female.
Right, I remember that
so
on the
that
butterfly show.
She's
yeah.
for at least for a while is not open to another male.
So this would be a sperm competition.
Right.
Okay, so that's an interesting phrase to think about. On the level of insects, and even in humans, there may be something like that. I don't really know.
I don't know.
But there's a whole field for study, so somebody out there with a PhD or was looking for one, get on that job.
Right.
Okay, and we'll be back again in our second segment, and Carol is going to talk some more about
right.
sex. What about
sexual conflict?
Sexual conflicts. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, a naturalist, with another segment of our show. And today's sponsor is a Whole Foods Markets. And my guest today is Carol Butler, who's done a lot of research, and she works in the field of therapy and counseling. So she has a big background of dealing with humans. I don't think she's ever canceled a mosquito or a butterfly yet, but
I talked to the butterflies in the conservatory.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's true. Okay, so Carol, we were talking about sexual conflict in the first section.
I was just thinking, in the conservatory this week, there was a beautiful pair of Cairns birdwings who were mating. These are beautiful, big, Australian, colorful butterflies.
Oh, yeah, you sent me the picture of them. They look like the owl butterfly. Don't they have a big eye spot? Yeah.
But they're very colorful. They're different color. Right. So there was the butterflies mate for a really long time. This is how they control paternity, right? Many species pass as much as 90% of non-fertile sperm in the ejaculate. So they fill up the female's reproductive system with this useless stuff.
Yeah.
But it turns off her desire to mate with another male. Because many butterflies are polyandrous. They mate with a number of males. But he tries to stop her. That's his counter strategy, is by depositing all of this non-fertile sperm along with the fertile sperm. So there was a pair mating. Usually we are in the conservatory for 2 hours, and when you come in and there's a pair mating, usually when you leave, they're still mating, right?
That's pretty common in butterflies.
Very common, yeah, right. And so I don't know beyond 2-3 hours how long they actually stay paired, but it's very common for them to stay that long.
Yeah, I was always pretty jealous of butterflies. Of the males especially, they had that staying power.
Right, the women also always get this look in their eye when you see this.
Okay, and also I was jealous because they could take off in the air and fly together and still continue the act. But so that would be called a flying fornication.
So what this Friday when I was there, what relates to this was this couple was mating for almost 2 hours, and the male, when butterflies mate, the male has claspers at the end of his abdomen that attach to the female's abdomen, and so they're end to end, right? And she clearly had enough. The female was above, and she was trying to get unhooked from this male.
From the claspers.
And she was flapping her wings. These are big butterflies, and the female's bigger than the male. And it was interesting because he was not letting go. And you could really see this whole evolutionary battle being played out. It went on for about half an hour. I really thought she was going to fly away and get loose, but he held on. Finally, the next time I looked, she was gone.
Okay, you didn't interfere with being a female.
I didn't counsel them. I just observed quietly, tried not to intrude.
Oh, good.
So now I'll give a couple of examples. And just back to butterflies, let's stick with that. Males, when they transfer the sperm packet, they also transfer nutrients, right? And the nutrients enhance female fertility. So it's another reason that it makes it attractive for the female to mate with a number of males, because she gets more nutrients by doing
that.
Right,
they're called sperm packets for that reason. Is not only do they have sperm, but they have nutrients that they pass on to the females.
Right, so that if she wants the nutrients, she has to mate, but then she can get rid of some of the ejaculate if she can manage it as a counter strategy. And the male is trying to switch off her receptivity to the next male, which is his counter strategy.
Right.
Okay. Then there's the case of the Australian redback spider, which is a very interesting one, I think. Females kill the males before copulation is complete. This has the wonderful name of premature cannibalism.
Only in Australia.
And it only happens, right, you have wonderful stories about Australia.
Yeah.
It only happens if the male's courtship is brief. So if the male copulates, or courts her for less than 100 minutes, he kills her before copulation is complete. So if she courts her for less than 100 minutes, whatever he does, I don't know what they do. Butterflies hover and do all kinds of display, as do birds. They dive and carry on. So we assume the spider does something like that. Once he lasts for more than 100 minutes, she rarely kills him.
I wonder if they have a little watch. You think they have Timexes, mini Timexes? How did,
they're
called copulation watches.
Well, Fornicata watches,
there you
right.
go, Fornicata.
But
it's a whole new market.
Right, and okay. How do they know? I mean, this is one right. of the one of the interesting subjects in biology. So some researchers staged competitions with males who were courting females with and without competitive males. And what they found is when a resident male courted a female beyond her courtship threshold, which means more than 100 minutes, and then an intruder was introduced, the intruding male mated very rapidly with the female and was not cannibalized.
Really? Huh.
So he didn't pay his dues. He didn't do the 100-plus minutes of courtship. But once she was primed by all that courtship, she would mate with a random male who came along.
Mm-hmm. You think we could say she was still turned on?
Right, exactly. Okay. Yes, I think that's the case. So the researchers, clearly the female doesn't, once she's in that state beyond 100 minutes, she doesn't distinguish between the male the resident male or the intruder, right? So they say that it may lead to the selection for lower quality males who haven't had the wherewithal to do this in this lengthy courtship display.
Mm-hmm.
But it strikes me that they may not necessarily be lower quality. They may be smarter because they recognize and seek out webs in which a competitor is already present and which another male has already put out all the energy to get the female in the mood, and they just come along and share their sperm.
Hmm. Well, it's a way to keep their head.
And they minimize the risk of getting cannibalized.
Exactly. Yes.
Right. So,
okay, so
that's a really good example.
We don't know. That's interesting. I don't think the spiders would talk about it, though.
Right.
It's too personal.
To be continued. We have to get more information about
it. Okay.
Right? Yeah. So then another immediate benefit. Now, we're just talking generally again, sort of in the insect, more or less, the insect world. Sometimes there's an immediate benefit to a male that has a direct cost to the female that he wants to mate with, but it may have an indirect benefit to her via a quality that gets inherited by her sons. And they call this the sexy sons.
Sexy son syndrome.
Great
right. name, sexy son syndrome.
So that a choosy female may benefit from mating with even a harmful male. If he's actually a sexy male that can transmit his sexiness to his sons, because his sons will be more attractive and will more readily mate with other females, and so the genes will be passed along.
Mm, right? That's really interesting to think that an insect could have this plan. I mean, I'm sure it's just a biological basis.
Yeah, I don't think it's a plan.
It's a sexy a male is a sexy male, and then she wants to copulate with him.
Right, but it's fascinating that the females, and again, if you think of this broadly, here the female benefits by being manipulated or seduced, right? Because of the benefit for her children.
Mm.
So. I mean, and you think about human behavior and the success of seductive males, although it doesn't necessarily provide this benefit for the female, right?
Yeah. Huh.
But it might. I mean, maybe in the biological route is the same, that a seductive male will have seductive sons, or will have, you know, attractive sons who will
right.
pass along the gene pool more readily.
Yeah, I wonder if that's still... goes for females too. You said basically the youth thing is because the woman is in good shape to give birth, but mm-hmm. maybe also the attractive female is attractive because he's also thinking about his children.
Absolutely.
Who have attractive
right.
children who will be success in reproduction also.
Absolutely. We know yeah. that once a woman is in her close to 40, I think 37 is the age where the ratios start, things like illnesses like Down syndrome
yes.
become much more likely
right.
in the children.
Yeah, so birth defects in general.
Birth defects, right. And certainly a lot of them are age-related in terms of the reproductive availability of the female. Okay.
Okay, we're going to run out of time shortly, so wrap it up.
Oh, I thought I just wrapped it up.
Okay, good. So these strategies, you know, we're talking about insects, but they certainly apply to other critters besides insects.
Right.
And we're going to sign off shortly and take a break. And remember that this is The Naturalist, and my guest today is a special guest, is Carol Butler, who's done a lot of research. And we're brought to you by Whole Foods Markets, our sponsor. And we'll be back in a minute for the third section of this show. Okay, so this is the third segment of this show, Bernie Wide's The Naturalist, with our sponsor today, Whole Foods Markets. And my guest is Carol Butler, and Carol is going to continue talking about these sexual conflicts and strategies for survival, I guess.
Right. There's also a new study that I've been telling everybody in the conservatory about how butterflies actually drink the nectar.
Oh,
so if
right.
we have
that's
time,
good.
I'd like to talk about that too, because that's very exciting, and everybody's all of us butterfly folks are very interested in that.
Yeah. By the way, Carol, just let me tell everybody that when we refer to conservatory, a conservancy, we're talking about the American Museum of Natural History, where we have a live butterfly vivarium all winter long, from October to May.
Right.
And that's where I met Carol. We both volunteer there. And that's why she keeps referring to butterflies, because they're such fascinating and beautiful critters.
Right.
So, okay, Carol.
So, yes, come to the conservatory. It's wonderful. Okay, so back to sexual conflict before we get to the butterflies. In some species, there's evidence of sexual conflict in utero. Right. So this is a study about, they found this in sheep, but I suspect it's not only true of sheep. That if there is a male and a female twin in the uterus, the male produces androgens which affect the development of the female.
Which male does it?
The male fetus.
The male fetus,
yeah.
Oh, produces the androgens.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And this is just an unmanaged population that they studied. And so the female lambs, when they're born, have a reduced birth weight when compared to females who have a female twin in utero.
Okay, so what do these androgens do? They're like hormones?
Right, but it's a sex hormone.
Sex hormone, okay.
Affects somehow, I don't think we know how, but it inhibits the development of the female fetus.
Mm-hmm.
So she is born smaller than normal, and it has a lifetime effect on her breeding success. So the male is competing with her from the fetal stage.
The other twin.
The male twin, right. Mm-hmm. And she will have lower lifetime breeding success, which is mainly due to differences in first-year survival, which means mm-hmm. that these small females don't necessarily even survive the first year in order to reproduce.
Because they have a low birth weight.
Right.
And they're small.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So these are serious consequences for the survival of her gene pool, right?
Right.
When the male is out competing her in utero.
Mm.
This is pretty rough.
This is down and dirty, boy.
Right.
Oh.
And then the other sort of interesting example is in animals where the male lacks a penis. I think of birds, for example, because I wrote a book about hummingbirds and one about birds of prey. Birds of Prey is coming out in the fall. Hummingbirds is coming out in March, where the birds mate by having what they call a cloacal kiss. The cloaca is a little storage pouch at the end of the digestive and reproductive tract in the males and females, and they exchange
semen
fluid, right, ejaculate, through by putting the one opening against the other. I started writing about birds. I didn't know anything about birds, and I could not imagine this because I had had parakeets and canaries as a child.
Yeah.
And the, what is that music? That's not our theme music.
No, that's not. That's our phone, which I forgot to shut off.
Okay,
that's about
sounded nice.
Let's kill that.
I remember when I was started writing about birds, I said, I don't understand how they can do this because they just have this little opening under the tail.
Yeah, that's amazing that they can do this.
Yeah. So, and it's very convoluted. I said, I have to see this. So, of course, you can find on the internet, you can find videos of it. And we have a wonderful drawing in the Raptor book because I insisted we had to have an image for people like me who didn't know what this looked like.
Now, let's make this clear. We're not talking about oral genital sex. We're talking about genital sex with two cloacas coming together.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Is it called a cloaca also in the male?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The male gets on top of the female.
Yeah.
And the female moves her tail aside, and somehow the male kind of drops his bottom down, and somehow they manage to get those cloacas near each other, and unlike butterflies, they stay like that for just seconds.
It's very brief.
Very brief.
Yeah.
So it's quite impressive that they can pull this off.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, again, in terms of sexual conflict, you can imagine it's difficult to transfer the sperm to the female unless she cooperates.
Right. Yeah. She has to be ready and in right position. Position is everything.
Position is everything. Yeah, right. However, there is enforced copulation among animals that don't have penises. But I think that it's for other reasons. I know that with raptors, we read some interesting studies that I wrote about in the book.
Yeah, raptors are birds of prey, like hawks and eagles and
falcons,
ospreys and all those.
Right, owls, right. So birds of prey are territorial, and they stake out a certain area, and the couple stays together in that area, and they don't really want any intruders to come in because they might steal the mate or they might cannibalize the offspring.
Right.
And people observe these raptor territories. This is, again, you spoke about why interesting biological studies. There's a lot of research where people watch the territories and count the number of times that the raptors fornicate, right?
Yes. And
we shouldn't call it, I guess, mate. We shouldn't call it fornicate.
No, because
they're not under an arch.
And, you know, they're doing it with the same female.
Right.
So we won't call it prostitution.
But what people have found in the research is that they mate excessively because they only lay one or two eggs in a breeding cycle. So there's no reason to mate 20 or 30 times.
Once they've laid the eggs too.
So the speculation, of course we can't ask them, but the speculation is that this, again, is for reproductive advantage, that this is to demonstrate, to display to any other raptor that's considering coming into the territory, this is our territory, this is my partner, stay away, don't bother us, and don't try to come into this area and cause trouble.
Yeah, and I think that the raptors tend to be monogamous.
Right, they do.
Yeah, more than a lot of other critters.
That's right, that's right.
And what I have for you is the new Pale Male videotape.
Oh, wonderful.
Which shows that, and I meant to bring it today, but it's raining. I didn't want to bring it out.
Okay, thank you.
And for the folks listening in, Pale Male is the famous red-tailed hawk that lives across the street from Central Park on one of the Fifth Avenue buildings. And he now, I think, has his third or fourth wife.
Right.
And only because the other ones died.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them died because the raptors are terrific. They eat pigeons and they eat mice.
Right.
And the city sometimes puts down rat poison, which kills the rats.
Right.
And then if they eat the poison rat, it sometimes kills the hawks.
Mm-hmm.
So this famous pale male. There's just been another video made about him, and it'll probably be on PBS one of these days.
Right,
and
well, that's
I have a copy
for
you.
Oh, thank you, thank
it.
You.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, wrap
so
it up.
I think I have time. Do I have, is it 1 minute or?
1 minute.
Okay, so I don't think I even have time to talk about the butterfly proboscis. We'll have to leave that like you left the definition of fornicata dangling.
Fornication,
we'll,
right.
We'll leave. We always say that butterflies sip the nectar.
Right.
And we have discovered that they don't necessarily sip the nectar, that they don't have any way to suck the nectar up. So they do it, well, should I tell or should I leave it?
No, leave it hanging.
All right, I'm going to leave it hanging so that I'll get invited back to explain how they get the nectar into their bodies.
Right. Tune in for the further adventures.
Stay tuned. This
right.
is a
stay
real
tuned.
Cliffhanger.
Right. So this is Bernie Wides wrapping it up for today for this show with Carol Butler, who is always fascinating. Thank you.